Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Less than a day remains of a temporary ceasefire in Gaza. The three-day truce is held as negotiators from both sides attend talks in Cairo, mediated by Egyptian officials. While the international community holds out hope for a suspension of hostilities, we turn to NPR's coverage of the conflict.
Climb over a pile of rubble and through a hole in the wall, followed by
many rockets have landed inside Israel. Israeli forces actually say that 57 have landed during the course.
As NPR ombudsman Edward Schumacher Matos receives and investigates listener feedback, he read a number of complaints from listeners about NPR's coverage of the crisis in Gaza as the conflict heated up in July and August. Hundreds of listeners accused NPR of pro-Israeli bias. Many more were outraged by what they perceived as a pro-Palestinian bent. Both sides listening to the same stories and hearing distinctly different things. I asked Edward what kind of specific complaints he's getting about NPR's coverage of the conflict.
Well, generally, people from each side of this dispute see NPR as being biased against their side. They point to different stories, and this is common that folks in looking for bias feel that they really remember, they put the greater emphasis on the stories they disagree with and don't hear as much the stories they agree with or don't remember them as much.
Well, so you go through and track them as ombudsman. How do you even answer the accusation of how bias breaks down, you know, in NPR coverage in terms of pro-Palestinian or pro-Israeli, if we're going to put it in those terms?
Well, I take the complaints very seriously, and I do go back to see, do they have a point? What do they find? And so often they'll point out a certain story, and that story will indeed focus on just one side of the issue or the other side of the issue, but doesn't take into account that there are other stories that say the opposite.
So those are the stories. Do you actually track how the accusations break down?
Yes, I'd say that the complaints probably ran about 60% pro-Israeli and about 40% pro-Palestinian, in the sense that, you know, they're criticizing the stories as being, you know, biased against their side. Curiously, I think that, you know, years ago the breakdown would have been maybe 70-30, mm-hmm. 80-20. So it begins to show a shift that's taking place in the American body
politic.
Right.
It sounds parallel pretty much with the general mood of the country about the conflict.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. I think it kind of reflects American public opinion.
So I have to ask you again, you went through and reviewed four bias stories since the bodies of the three Israeli teens kidnapped in the West Bank turned up on mm-hmm. June 30th. How do you actually calculate bias?
That is so hard. It's a very subjective measure. I have to just try to look at it the best I can. I try to point out different passages in the stories that show different points of view. There is no one objective way of doing this. I just try to give it my own independent look at it, taking very seriously what the complaints are. Put them out there, lay it out for listeners to check my own check on it. I mean, put links to all the stories and let listeners go back and say, well, do they agree with me or not agree with me? I hope what I'm doing is pointing out the many different things NPR is doing at the same time in one place so that a listener, depending no matter where they're coming from on this dispute, can then follow up and do their own research and see if indeed NPR is doing pretty good from even their point of view.
And even after your review, what kind of responses did you get?
I think the response was positive for the most part. I think most people, you know, appreciated that there was a real honest attempt to come to grips with this thing and a place that did indeed pull all of NPR's coverage together so that they could see the bigger picture.
Beyond the criticism of taking sides, how do you mm-hmm. address the charge that NPR is not identifying which side is, quote unquote, at fault in this conflict?
Yes. Needless to say, those who have very strong feelings on the dispute feel that the other side is at fault. There are two levels of looking at this issue of fault. One is who started this particular fighting that we've had for the last month in Gaza. And who's at fault, more generally speaking, in the dispute between Israelis and Palestinians? And in terms of who started this particular episode that we've had, you know, I think the NPR coverage has been very clear in showing that what really ratcheted up the level of violence was the rockets. But at the same time, it shows that there are some longer standing complaints among people in Gaza that they were feeling frustrated about and that Hamas tried to exploit. But in terms of the bigger dispute between Israelis and Palestinians, I do think that NPR correctly takes a framing of the issue that there's no question about the legitimacy of the state of Israel.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've heard a lot of on-the-ground reporting, but also I've heard interviews with very high-level officials from both sides. Again, you know, I dislike using that term both sides, as if there are only mm-hmm. two sides to this thing. What do you hear from listeners when it comes to analysis?
Yes, I think listeners want more analysis. I do think in the early days of the reporting of this particular conflict, there wasn't that much analysis on NPR. There were practical reasons for that. One, the regular Jerusalem correspondent was on vacation when everything broke out. So you had Ari Shapiro flying in from London to fill in. You had a stringer doing yeoman work. And you had a fast-moving chain of events that you don't have time to do the analysis oftentimes. But NPR, I think, quickly caught up both on air and online.
Well, I know I heard interviews with, for example, the Gazan political scientist Abu Sada and also from the Israeli ambassador Ron Derma. Do you feel like that sort of balance of, you know, hear from one side, hear from the other side, is that essential, that sort of tit for tat in covering a topic like this?
Yeah, I really do think it is. And I think that it's good that NPR allows an interview to go on for 4, 5, 6, 7 minutes so that you can really hear someone's reasoning and decide whether or not you agree with them or not. Some listeners will complain, and I can totally understand it, that, hey, why aren't you pushing this guy harder? Why don't we have the other side reported at the same time? Well, for practical reasons, you just can't do it all at the same time. So they'd give, you know, they'll focus on the Israeli ambassador in this show, and in the next show they'll focus on the Palestinian professor or anybody else so that you get another point of view on the thing. And I personally, as a listener, I like to hear what these guys have to say. Even if you know that they're
even
spinning some.
Even if it sounds like spin, you know, through the bullet points.
Yes, but you know, we're sophisticated as listeners. We know when to think, oh, this could be spinning, this may not be. We do want our hosts who do the interviews to push the guys some, but there's a level of civility that we want to maintain too on the radio.
Well, more than once, Edward, and I'm guessing this has happened to you, you know, I've been at public forums or in one-on-one conversations with listeners, and I hear statements like, people need to know the truth. You know, why can't you just focus on telling the truth? And, you know, I always say, well, actually, I'm not going to say what I say. How would you respond to that?
Truth is a very slippery concept. Truth is oftentimes is in the eyes of the beholder. But that said, we do try to come out with some sort of a factual truth. I do think that it is, that NPR has to correct people when something they say is not factually right. That said, the interpretations can be very different. And so one person's truth about interpretation could be very different from somebody else's truth.
Mm. I'm wondering about the whole, you know, we talk a lot about objectivity in journalism, but I'm wondering about objectivity in listeners. I mean, you've been examining this for 3 years as ombudsman for NPR. Before that, ombudsman for the Miami Herald, you know, many years in senior positions for Spanish language dailies and the New York Times. I mean, is it too reductionist to say people just believe what they want to believe?
Well, we all do that. And unfortunately, we're doing it more and more as a society. It's regretful to see the way that we are all flocking more and more to news sites and news outlets that reflect a point of view and that they're our point of view and that it kind of just confirms our own beliefs and makes us harder and more intransigent in them. And it's a shame, and we see it in the polarization of American society today, and it makes it more difficult to have some kind of an amicable political discussion.
Have you ever gotten a letter from someone that says, well, you know, I listened, this really made me rethink my position, I've changed my mind?
Actually, I have gotten that, believe it or not. And I get it so often when somebody starts out very angry and you try to, but you listen to them and take them seriously. Because so often the anger has to do that people feel that no one's actually listening to them. And they can just, either just mouth off to mouth off or, you know, to say stuff that they wouldn't say in polite company. Or they have a genuine frustration. And if you can sort of show empathy for where they're coming from, and then try to explain how there may be another way of seeing this, you can actually get people to say, they might not totally agree with you. They might say, oh, I don't agree, but okay, I understand that other side. And if you do that, you've accomplished a lot.
NPR Ombudsman Edward Schumacher Matos there. I asked friends on Facebook how they are hearing NPR's coverage. Some said NPR is decidedly pro-anything Muslim. Others compared it to Fox News in its pro-Israeli bent. The majority of, and let me highlight, completely self-selecting friends said that, like NPR's ombudsman, they find the reporting to be even-handed. My old high school buddy Daryl posted this: if you're annoying anyone, you're probably doing a good job. Confirmation bias, selective perception, cherry-picking, call it what you will, but humans have a curious way of interpreting information. Whether they're hearing news, combing through horoscopes, or watching a political debate, we seek out information that confirms our belief systems and our sense of belonging. That reminded me of an earlier conversation with Chris Mooney. He's a science and political journalist and author of The Republican War on Science. And he's long been investigating the psychological phenomenon known as motivated reasoning, especially as it relates to climate change denial, and finds that there is a reason why, even when faced with overwhelming evidence to the contrary, people are unwilling to accept certain realities.
The purpose is that it helps you protect your sense of self, helps you protect your identity, and it's actually not necessarily strange or irrational that we would be this way. First, just in general, evolution would have built us to be able to react to stimuli very, very quickly in case we need to get away from them. But moreover, when it comes to beliefs and ideas, you know, we build them up over long periods of time in our mind. We make big investments in them. These are our identities, and it makes sense that we wouldn't just discard them easily. So what's so striking about it is that if you and I look on the outside and we say, that person's being hypocritical, they just changed their position, or, you know, they're moving the goalposts, and we're from the outside, we're saying, well, they're moving the goalposts, but from their minds, they're engaging in motivated reasoning. They don't see the contradiction.
Our investments in identity can lead us to, as the saying goes, hear what we want to hear. And that motivation extends far beyond climate science to sports teams, to interpersonal relationships, to geopolitics. Well, while interested people the world over await results of the mediated discussions in Cairo, you can count on the facts here on NHPR. Up next on Word of Mouth, how the 2011 London riots inspired one woman to embark on a mission to complete 366 days of kindness. Can benevolent gestures help a city heal? We'll find out after the break. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. During the leap year of 2012, a woman in London embarked on a curious mission to complete 366 days of kindness. Her efforts were prompted by the riots that spread through her adopted hometown of London and across English towns and cities between the 6th and 10th of August in 2011. Bernadette has left sweets in phone boxes, books on trains, written letters to soldiers returned from Afghanistan, and offered her socks to the homeless. She says she expected nothing in return. Christy McGuire brings us her story.
This is going to be interesting. I think it's a bit crazy. They probably wonder what's going on.
Hello.
Hello. My name's Bernadette, and I'm a regular customer of yours. And exactly a year ago today, I came in here, and there was a boy in front of me in the queue at the post office, and he didn't have enough money for his stamp, and I paid for his stamp. And then after that, I decided to try and do something kind for a stranger every day. And because it started here, I thought I'd finish it here, so I bought you some flowers.
My name is Mukesh Kumar, and I am working here last 3 years. Helping people or something that is good for the community, for the people, so other people get lesson from that.
21st of October 2011, 64th day of kindness. Gave £5 to lady who had her bike nicked. 27th of October 2011, 70th day of kindness. Took homemade cupcakes to my favourite charity shop in Deptford. 27th of November. I started on August the 18th, 2011. Nobody paid particular attention to it until they started noticing that I was still doing it. And now people are like, oh my, I can't believe that I'm still doing it, that I've kept it up. Day of kindness. Left sweets in a phone box.
They're £6 a bunch.
So I've given flowers a few times to strangers. It's pretty impulsive. I'll go to the florist and choose the most cheerful colour. You know, it's more Amelie than Gandhi, do you know what I mean? It was fun for me as well. I might just wander around and see who looks like they could do with it. Approaching the Soho sex shops. This fetish wear shop, an adult-only tattooist claiming to sell original Viagra, something called Camagra Jelly. I've no idea what that does. Poppers. It's quite a lively shop. Hello.
Yeah.
Just see if there's anyone anywhere in the doorway of this. There's some peep show shops. I'm going to give them to this lady. There must be something that opens in you when you do anything as a daily practice. Approaching strangers with openness every single day, after a relatively short period of time, just becomes instinct. Hello. My name's Bernadette, and every day I try and do a kind thing for a stranger. It's just like a good deed. Okay. So I wondered if I could give you these. I never really get rejection now. I don't get that. Or maybe it's just that I don't receive it as rejection. So that's it.
That's it?
Yeah, I've been doing it every day since... you know the riots happened in London last year?
Yeah,
because it was very upsetting.
Yeah.
And so I decided I was going to try and do something nice for someone every day.
That's amazing.
And today is my 358th day. Yeah. I'm doing 366 because it's a leap year, isn't it?
Okay, okay. Terrific. So, yeah. Thank you. I won't forget.
What's your name,
sorry? Anne.
Give us a hug.
Okay.
Mm. Nice to meet you. Enjoy too. Your flowers.
I will.
It'll suit you.
Big surprise. Thank you very much.
For me, it came out of a grief mixed with anger for and on behalf of London.
Rioting is now on a scale not seen in the UK for decades.
There are pockets of our society that are not just broken, but frankly sick. We have seen the worst of Britain, but I also believe we've seen some of the best of Britain.
It was really as simple as, I don't know what I can... That's so big. So there's just a little thing I can do. 46th day of kindness. Another gift through the post, this one for Wendy Dumper. And Wendy emailed me back saying, as I opened the box and looked in lovingly at the gifts, my face felt like a big beam of smiles, and then I started to sob tears of joy. It really was a wonderful moment, even though it was just me. I normally write a little card. Okay. On the envelope it says, read me. It's a little Alice in Wonderland reference, really. And then on the other side, there's a little golden star, and it says, when you wish upon a star, it might come true. So it's just like a kind of a little bit of... light-hearted magic.
I was going through a really, really rough patch. I had no job. I'd just had a hip replacement. I was at home. I was really on the edge. Suddenly, this card came in the post with all sorts of little details on, and inside was this message.
Hello, stranger. Hello, and thank you for accepting this small gift. This is to wish you a wonderful day and to invite you to make a wish.
And it just came from nowhere. I had no idea why it was there. I kind of opened it, and then I was so kind of freaked out by it. You know, and I was in such a dark space, I just put it back in the envelope and I put it on top of the telly.
I don't usually meet the people that I give these things to because they are strangers, I just have to think, well, maybe that's cheer them up, and I'm not going to know. But I quite like that I don't know what the result of it is.
Every now and then I would go up and I would look at it. It was kind of like a drug. But I always put it back in the envelope. It was like I couldn't leave it out because that'd be like taking the drug all the time. Now it's out. It's like, you know, when it's your birthday or Christmas, you have cards out for a certain amount of time. This will stay out forever.
A friend of mine, Sharon, she said, oh, I'm going to take up the baton. So she's going to start doing 366 Days of Kindness. We're hoping that we're going to pass it on every year to someone else. The only thing I think I've done any good at all is demonstrating that you can just do a little thing. The only way to change the world is to change yourself. So I can't change government policy and I can't change people's minds about each other. I can change myself. That's all I can do. That's all any of us can do.
And that story produced by Christy McGuire. Coming up, forget the stars of Hollywood, London's music scene, the fashion of Milan, and the bright lights of Tokyo. South Korea is aiming to become the world's chief exporter of cool. We'll get that story after the news. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Who hasn't seen at least a clip of the video for Gangnam Style?
Open Gangnam Style! Gangnam Style!
It is an easy dance to mimic. The video has horses, fake snow, dancing girls, and the enigmatic Psy in wingtips and a blue tux. Gangnam Style was the first video to rack up a billion hits on YouTube and part of the calculated strategy of Hallyu, or the influence and export of South Korean pop culture onto the global landscape. Korean movies, K-pop music acts, games, and TV shows in particular are proliferating throughout the global South and could be Korea's gateway to becoming an international superpower, even by American standards. Yuni Hong is author of The Birth of Korean Cool, How One Nation is Conquering the World Through Pop Culture. Yuni Hong, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you, Virginia. I'm happy to be here.
South Korea, just 50 years ago, you describe as having a GDP lower than Ghana and even North Korea. Now it's the 15th largest economy in the world. How did it come from so far behind so quickly?
Yes, well, basically a lot of developing countries currently are trying to figure out this very thing. The short answer is that Korea is what I describe as the only capitalist liberal democracy on earth that runs like a command economy. What do I mean by that? I
yes.
mean that since the very beginning, the government and its private industry have worked closely in cooperation on basically every major decision in order to advance the economy. And this has extended even to the current somewhat crazy-sounding project of making Korea the world's top exporter of popular culture.
Well, what you describe in the book is this strategy very much by design, a government-led initiative to do no less than dominate developing world markets in pop culture. How? Can you bring us through the strategy?
Yes. I would say, first of all, to preface this, I think everyone, including Korea, realizes that they are not going to replace the United States as the main exporter of pop culture, but they are probably going to replace its monopoly on world pop culture. And what I mean by that is that Korea is going after markets that the United States does not really care about, either because they're too poor, like Paraguay or Zimbabwe, or because they consider America to be a harbinger of sin, like the part of the world that's been taken over by Islamist fundamentalism. A lot of American programming that used to be popular in places like Iran, maybe in the 60s or 70s, is now either outright illegal or can only be shown after midnight. And Korea makes these dramas, by contrast, that are very chaste. There's usually no kissing until episode 10. And this is a perfect fit for the Arab market. And in fact, in Iran, there's a show that has taken 80% of viewership, which is called My Love from Another Star. It's actually one of the most famous Korean dramas worldwide. It's about an alien from outer space who came to Korea in the 17th century. And in the 21st century, he falls in love with an actress. And if they kiss in episode 10, but he almost dies. And so it's very much this old-fashioned, almost Jane Austen throwback. And this works really, really well in a lot of world markets.
Mm-hmm.
무슨 15초?
내 별명이 15초의 요정이야. 15초짜리 광고만으로 사람들을 확 다 사로잡거든.
Can you describe Korean diplomats actually smuggling tapes of television programs to Hong Kong, for example? The Korean government paying to have shows dubbed into Spanish? It's so interesting given the huge strides that Korea's made in technology and business and education that making a choice of Korean pop culture, where does that stack up in the priorities for Korea as a country?
Right now, it's the number one priority, actually. It's wow. The government's stated policy.
So can we draw a line directly from government ministry? In fact, there was a ministry created for this purposes to PSY, for example.
PSY is a very strange instance of the exception proving the rule. On the one hand, nobody in Korea, I should say, was surprised that it was a Korean video that got a billion hits on YouTube. However, everyone was surprised that it was this particular artist. And I say that because PSY is considered an outlier. He did not go through the K-pop factory system. He writes his own songs, which is extremely unusual. He has the wrong look. He's a little too old. And he makes fun of things that Korea thinks are kind of sacred. And so it was very much an in spite of thing. The Korean entertainment industry was grooming the more attractive conventional bands like Girls' Generation and Big Bang. PSY came out of nowhere. I don't think even he knows why he was the shot heard around the world.
Yeah, and K-pop, I guess, to just describe those bands further, sort of boy bands, you know, some of them under multi-year, 12-year development contracts to groom these kind of stars for the system. This strategy would be impossible without the concept of Han, if I'm saying that properly.
Yes.
Han is what you introduce us to as driving the country. Now, what does that mean to you? What is Han?
Han is a culturally specific form of anger, vengeance, wrath that can make you so upset that you could actually literally die from it. And this is a disease that appears in the DSM manual, which is the Bible for the Psychiatric Institute. It's like dying of a broken heart, except you're dying of of unfulfilled vengeance. And by definition, only Korean people can have it. I like to describe it as the opposite of karma, because whereas karma can be worked off from one lifetime to the other, Han actually only accumulates. So you inherit the rage of millennia of the generations from the minute that you're born. This has a lot to do with influencing the Korean work ethic, their drive, their desire to beat Japan in the economic wars was a huge motivator because they're ancient rivals. And it's one of the most enduring and mysterious mutual animosities in the modern world, actually. And I don't know if this is true in general, but for Korea, their wrath actually keeps them alive. It's what they live for, which makes them stronger. And in fact, Ian Fleming in his James Bond series said, Koreans are the cruelest race, as a way of explaining why he had Odd Job as his manservant.
Well, which would make a lot of people roll their eyes, but you said reading it as a kid felt somehow vindicated, like they got it right.
No, exactly. I was just wondering, wow, did he spend time in Korea? How did he know that? Because that was something that I really observed, is that I've never seen so many random fistfights between, you know, people, you know, dressed in nice three-piece suits, you know, where it's considered socially acceptable to just have enemies. And where nobody, you know, will just tell you to let things go.
We're talking about the South Korean soul, I guess, and also its strategy for global domination through pop culture, from kimchi to Gangnam Style. What it's doing and how it's working is the subject of Yoon Hee-hong's book, The Birth of Korean Cool, How One Nation is Conquering the World Through Pop Culture. For the book, you spoke to Lee Moon-won, one of Korea's most influential pop critics. He tells you that Koreans are not good at creativity. This is maybe a stereotype we've heard before. Koreans don't innovate, they copy. So why have filmmakers like Park Chan-wook and musicians like Psy, for example, been able to cross over?
Yes, I would say that of all of the pop culture exports, film is the one that is the least profitable for precisely the reasons that you mentioned. They're highly artistic, which is why the French love Korean film. They're also violent and they lack the chastity that it described in the Korean dramas. And it's basically sort of the one area where if you're genuinely creative and not that commercially oriented, you will probably enter film. I think that Koreans are very philosophical and creative. But I think the point that the culture critic was trying to make is that what the secret behind Korean success in pop culture is that they're extremely good at packaging. So, for example, your average K-pop song, the song itself will have been usually it comes from Sweden. The studios buy Swedish songs by the thousands. The choreography might be done by an American. And it's all just sort of assembled, but the assembly itself does require creativity. So I would, in that sense, qualify the culture critic statement. The way that it's packaged is very plug-and-play. In the case of literal packaging, one of the reasons Korean music does so well is that they're actually making CDs that can cost $150 because they come with all these bells and whistles. And that's why they've conquered the Japanese market even more than American music has, because for some reason, Japan really buys a lot of CDs. It goes against the trend of the rest of the world. Mm. So it's sort of an obvious marriage of demand and supply.
It's not just in Asia and South America that Hallyu is working. It's also penetrating the markets in France, for example. Why is it that it's not hitting it big in America?
So I think the dirty secret of the Korean wave is that they kind of don't really care if they get the American market, because in the state the world is in now, you can actually do really, really well without capturing the American market. They're not the only ones with money anymore.
Yuni Hong, I want to thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Okay. Thank you, Virginia. It's a pleasure.
Yuni Hong, author of The Birth of South Korean Cool, How One Nation is Conquering the World Through Pop Culture. While the Korean wave has yet to crash onto American shores with any significant volume, a few Korean films and filmmakers have landed cult or art house successes here. We previously spoke to Boston Globe film critic Ty Burr about the film Snowpiercer by director Bong Joon-ho. Snowpiercer had a very limited release in American theaters, but is now doing gangbusters on demand. After our conversation with Yuni Hong, we went back to Ty and asked him about other South Korean films that have been adapted for Western audiences in recent years.
Well, it's interesting. You know, Korean film is sort of in a similar position as a Japanese genre film was in about 10, 12 years ago, when Japanese movies like Ringu were getting remade as American horror movies, Ring. And in fact, Hollywood has a history of looking overseas, finding interesting creative stuff, and then dumbing it down for American audiences. Mm. The difference is, you know, the change in availability of these films, and you can pretty much get anything you want to get your hands on thanks to the internet. Snowpiercer, which is directed by Bong Joon-ho, is only the latest of his very wonderful movies. So yeah, you can see Bong Joon-ho's earlier movies. I mean, The Host got a pretty big release in the United States, and that is a wonderful monster movie, sort of like a tongue-in-cheek Godzilla with a sort of gonzo creative side of its own. But one of his early movies called Memories of Murder did get an art house release in this country, but very few people have seen it. And it's a fascinating movie, kind of like David Fincher's Zodiac. It's about the police trying to catch a serial killer. Hmm. Park Chan-wook is probably the other most well-known Korean director in this country, especially with his Vengeance trilogy, Lady Vengeance, Sympathy for Mr. Vengeance, and Old Boy, which was just remade by Spike Lee. Unnecessarily, but, you know, nice try.
South Korea has a pretty vibrant film industry, at least domestically. What do you think is behind that?
Like a number of other countries in the Pacific Rim, I think there's a real cross-fertilization in the many different aspects of their popular culture. So you've got, you know, comics and manga, and you know, the manga-like comics feeding into genre filmmaking and whatever's going on in TV and whatever's going on the internet and in music. You've just got a lot of young energy taking, you know, traditional American genres and ideas and taking them for a spin around the block and pulling them apart and putting them together in unusual ways. There's just a sort of freedom of movement between genres. One of the things I like about the new Korean filmmakers is that the films look like they're in a certain genre, but once you see the movies, they leap all over the fence. They go whichever way they want to.
What would you say characterizes or ties together the films that are coming out of South Korea?
Well, it's easy to say that there's a lot of interest in the more violent genres, suspense, action, horror, and that definitely is an aspect. But you do get some remarkable dramas and some – there's an aspect of romance there, but that hasn't played out in a lot of Korean film. I'm thinking of movies like Poetry by Lee Chang-dong, which is about an older woman taking poetry classes and dealing with tragedies in her life. Again, it sounds like typical art house fare, but it takes a couple of turns that make it feel really unusually fresh and incredibly moving at the end. Kim Kai-duk, who is a director who specializes in pretty outrageous genre fare, where his movies can get pretty graphic, made this absolutely gorgeous Buddhist movie, I mean, for lack of a better word, called Spring, Summer, Fall, Winter, and Spring, which was an art house hit here back, I think, in 2005.
I remember that one.
Yeah. It's very different from the movies he usually makes, but that's another instance of how you really can't pigeonhole a lot of these directors of the movies that they're making. I mean, it's when we're used to movies that really follow a set path, certainly the commercial multiplex movies in this country, and even the so-called independent films. You know, you go to a Woody Allen or a Wes Anderson movie, or certainly a Transformers movie, and you know how it's going to go. These movies, you don't know where they're going to go. You start at one point, and who knows where you'll end up.
Do you think they, just because of the language barrier, they'll ever be able to really transcend to the multiplex? I mean, Snowpiercer crossed over because it's made in English.
Snowpiercer crossed over because it's made in English and it has a box office star and still wasn't allowed to fully cross over. It's doing very, very well in on demand. But no, I mean, any movies with subtitles and not recognizable English language stars are not going to really take off in this country. The few exceptions I can think of are like Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, which, I mean, that was a fluke, and that was how long ago?
Mm-hmm.
So the Korean films are probably going to be cult favorites and sort of delights to an inside audience, which doesn't mean that outside audiences should go find them. And again, these are so much easier to find now. I would love to tell your listeners to go dig up The Host, Bong Joon-ho's The Host, or Spring, Summer, Fall, Winter, and Spring, or Poetry, or Old Boy, if they have the nerves of steel. Even something like a movie like Kim Jo-woon's The Good, the Bad, and the Weird. Not a great movie. It kind of goes over the top early and often, but it's a lot of fun, and it shows a director just sort of letting his imagination run free. I'd love more people to see these movies.
Well, we'll have a full list of those suggestions on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Ty, thanks so much for filling us in. Ty Burr, film critic for the Boston Globe and author of Gods Like Us on Movies, Stardom, and Modern Fame. A link to more on the book as well at wordofmouthradio.org. Sound design is an integral part of filmmaking and, as it turns out, also an important part of televised sporting events. The sound of sport and why you may not want to believe everything you hear when Word of Mouth continues. When it comes to watching televised sports, sound is a crucial part of the experience. If you'd like to put it to the test, next time you watch a game, try turning the sound off. But still, bringing life to televised sports through sound is more difficult than you might imagine, and often goes far beyond setting up a mic near the action. This story comes to us from Roman Mars' podcast 99% Invisible, and was produced by Peregrine Andrews.
This is 99% Invisible. I'm Roman Mars. If Dennis Baxter and Bill Whiston are doing their job right, you probably don't notice that they're doing their job. But they are so good at doing their job, you probably don't even know that their job exists at all. They are sound designers for televised sporting events. Their job is to draw the audience into the action and make sports sound as exciting as possible. And that doesn't mean that they throw a bunch of microphones on the field. This is Dennis Baxter, sound designer of the Olympics.
There's some sports that you just cannot capture the natural sound. Cross-country skiing, biathlon is another one. Because of the size of the course. And this has been further complicated because as the camera lenses have gone up 110, 120, 130, 140 to 1, these cameras are able to see a half a kilometer, maybe even a kilometer down the course. Now, how do you replicate that sound? Essentially, if you got cameras that are that far apart from each other, you're putting 20 or 30 microphones to fill as the athletes are coming to you, which is not practical. I am not a purist whatsoever in sound production. I truly believe that whatever the tool takes to deliver a high-quality, entertaining soundscape, it's all fair game. And that has caused some issues because I use samplers. What a sampler is, it's a keyboard. It's attached to essentially a digital recorder. When you hit the key on the keyboard, it triggers the sound to play back, and with the keyboard it also triggers with sensitivity, meaning that if I hit the key real hard, it'll have a little bit more of a harder attack, and you can vary the pitch. If I hit a C note that has a sample, and then I hit a D note of the same sample, it will be up a step. So for the skiing, it gives a shh, shh.
Redgrave and Pinson still hold the lead. The French in third, and we could do without seeing them at the moment.
In Atlanta, one of my biggest problems was rowing. Rowing is a 2-kilometer course. They have 4 chase boats following the rowers, and they have a helicopter. Okay, that's what they need to deliver the visual coverage of it. Okay, but the helicopter and the chase boats just completely wash out the sound. So no matter how good the microphones are, you cannot capture, you cannot reach and isolate sound like you do visually. But people have expectations, okay? If you see the rowers, they have a sound that they're expecting. So what do we do? That afternoon, we went out on a canoe with a couple of rowers and recorded stereo samples of the different type of effects that would be somewhat typical of an event. And then we loaded those recordings into a sampler and played them back to cover the shots of the boats.
And the Australians have bitten something back from them, but not enough. Great Britain, gold medals! Stephen Redgrave, Matthew Pinson, mission accomplished.
Stand by. And they're racing. Good even dispatch, although...
When we do our horse racing, you're not going to get somebody running around the course after the horses. There's no way. And occasionally you will come across very close-up pictures of the horses over the far side, which is done off one of our roving cameras. But you have engine noise in that case, so therefore you wouldn't want a microphone on that, because all you would hear is the car revving up and the cameraman cursing. So, basically, the way you cover all that sort of stuff is to run a tape which has the sound of horses' hooves galloping, which is actually, if I remember rightly, a slowed-down buffalo charge. That's pretty much a standard thing, and I think it's probably the same recording that they've used for years.
That story from Roman Mars podcast 99% Invisible and produced by Peregrine Andrews for Falling Tree Productions. It's an extract from a much longer and really stunning documentary called The Sound of Sport. You'll find the full documentary on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for joining us today. Earlier in the show, we spoke with NPR's ombudsman, Edward Schumacher Matos, about how listeners are hearing NPR's coverage of the Israel-Hamas conflict. As ombudsman, he investigates listener feedback, and he's received a number of complaints accusing NPR of pro-Israeli bias. Others are outraged by what they perceive as a pro-Palestinian bent, both listening to the same stories and hearing different things. Well, we'd like to hear from you. What have you heard? Have you heard a bias in NPR's coverage of the Gaza conflict? You can join the ongoing discussion on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. After all, the most challenging opinions tend to travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us for more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.